The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
If learning to use AI well is about delegating to a machine, you also still need to figure out how to delegate to the human delegating to the machine.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Diane Sadowski-Joseph. Diane is the co-founder of Clarinet, and pre-show we've been having some very cool conversations around where AI can be used in different ways for teams, and just, you know, what's happening in the world of technology and teams. So it's going to be a great conversation today. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. So what was it that brought you into this realm of work in this kind of exciting moment?
Yes. So I would say I routinely wake up and go, how do I do AI stuff? Because this is absolutely not where I thought I would be. My background, my professional background has always been on the kind of people and human and behavior change side of things. I started my career in adult learning. I worked abroad in the Czech Republic and in Shanghai and did a bunch of stuff like that and teaching leadership and all of this stuff. And then I spent many years in startups and scale-ups, you know, wearing all the different hats you wear of, you know, people operations, client services, marketing. I was an executive for 8 years at a leadership training company, helped scale that from five to 200 up through a six-figure exit. So it was, talk about meta, a leader of leadership trainers who teach leaders. It's turtle all the way down, which, I mean, it was fantastic. It's a great company. They're still around. They're called Life Labs Learning. Highly, highly recommend them. Anyhow, but then about three, almost 4 years ago now, you know, 2022, ChatGPT came onto the scene. Everyone was like, what is this? I've never been a tech enthusiast. I didn't have a smartphone until it was like embarrassing not to.
You held on to that Nokia.
Oh my gosh, my Nokia. Like my husband jokes because like on our first date, I had directions to the restaurant we went to written on an index card because I didn't have a smartphone. So anyhow, but so ChatGPT came on the scene and, you know, and I started kind of like playing around with it a little bit because other people were kind of playing around with it in my orbit. And then also because I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, I mean, you literally cannot walk down the street without AI being in your face all the time. I have a running joke of like, you know, driving to and from the airport, like, the percentage of billboards that name AI, we have not dropped below 90% in about 4 years.
Oh my gosh.
Basically, I think like many of us, I was having a little bit of an existential crisis of like, what is AI? What does it mean? What's it going to mean for the future? You know, I have two kids. I was like, what's the world we're creating? And so I was like, the only way to stop this is for me to learn enough about it so that I can start formulating my own opinion. So I went back to school. I took a class at Berkeley on AI and leadership and stuff like that. And I was also experimenting very heavily with it in the role that I was in. Mm-hmm. And basically came to two conclusions. One, I was like, this is actually really cool. Like, this is tech that actually is helpful, which is a thought that I've like never had before.
That's cool.
And then the second thought, like almost immediately, was, oh, people are going to need help with this because it is not intuitive as to how to use this, because fundamentally working with AI agents, agentic workflows, whatever you want to call it, we're delegating work to machines in a way we never have before. And if you've done leadership, you know, delegation is hard. And it's very much a skill. So I think like that's what got me into it. I was introduced to my co-founder by one of the co-founders of Life Labs Learning. And we hit it off. He had the same vision of, you know, we were like, we need to help people. How are we going to help humans and organizations thrive in the age of AI? And so we do AI adoption. We help you learn AI. We help your teams build AI. Like we actually help implement things if that's something you want. and we help scale kind of the culture of AI use, right? AI native practices. We do that with organizations, but we come at it with a very human first lens.
Love it.
Because fundamentally, I still believe that AI should be serving the humans, not the other way around. So
I love that. And it's fascinating right now. We were just having a conversation on that the other day, that when you think about humans and agents on a team together, to your point that the agents are serving the humans, we've got to start the philosophy of, are agents and humans treated as equals on that team, or is there a hierarchy? And what do we need to be doing to make sure that we protect and embrace what is truly human in that work as we carry it forwards? It's a really interesting question.
I have strong opinions on this.
Fire away. That's what I'm here for.
Probably not surprising. To me, I get really irritated with, I was talking to another amazing AI leader, kind of pioneer, also comes from kind of the people space. And we were just talking about how the idea of like the digital employee or like AI on the org chart is like a real pet peeve, because the reality is, this is a machine. This is a tool. Just because it is more quote unquote human-esque than any other tool, because it can kind of like chat to you in a way that sounds human, does not make it fundamentally different from like email, right?
Yes.
Or like, you know, Salesforce, or like any other labor-saving technology that for knowledge work. Now, it feels different, and that is important. Like the psychological
giving it a name
is not to be ignored. And if you want to give it a name, that's fine. Like I call my ChatGPT Chatty G. You know, like giving it a name is great from like a referencing standpoint, etc. But the reason I think it is so important to like keep the tech in its place is that first and foremost, tech cannot be accountable. And if you forget that for even a second, you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
Like, so fundamentally it's the humans who are going to be accountable for things. And therefore, if you're elevating the machine above the human and the human is still accountable for it, that's a recipe for like discontent, for like just a really unsustainable bad situation. But two, I think it's already hard enough. Like humans, it's already hard enough to center humans in the work in capitalism, right? Like it's already hard enough to prioritize like the human experience. I joked, I don't know if many of your listeners remember a couple of years ago, like there was a little kerfuffle around the performance platform Lattice, because they were like, we do like digital employee, you know, we now allow you to plug in your agents as digital employees. And I was like, my running joke was like digital employer 1099s, right? Because like, you know, like employer contractor, like, you know, it's like, we don't even have good definitions for that. Like for the humans in our org chart, like much less. And so I don't know. I think it can be a useful heuristic in terms of helping people think through how to delegate to these machines or the role of the machine. But I think to me, like, you have to resist the temptation to truly start personifying to the point where you're prioritizing them over your real humans.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anything good can come of it.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, because if I go into my like sci-fi experiences, like you think of a robot like a C-3PO or an R2-D2 of Star Wars, which a lot of people know. And they are making decisions and doing things, and probably C-3PO more so than R2-D2 has a human-esque experience and interface. But we're not there yet. And I think people who are sort of jumping too far ahead are creating a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of poor work. I think poor work, slop, I'm hearing is a word that's being used right now a lot. It is actually a bigger problem for our teams right now if we get ahead of over the front of our skis, in essence.
100%. And I think there's like, you know, to your point, I love the like C-3PO, R2-D2. It's kind of like, in some ways, we're not there yet. And it's also true that even when we get there, we also still need to remember that they are robots. And like, you know, because, you know, for example, C-3PO can be cut in half and be put back together. A human being cannot, right? Like,
great point.
Like, we need to, like, you know, like, but he also has like a, like, he can like be unplugged, you know? And like, and versus a human cannot. So like, I mean, I think it's one of those where, I, especially in and around San Francisco, there's a lot of tech futurism. And I, you know, everyone is welcome to think what they think, but yeah. I just feel like it's one of those where, like, why are we so excited about replacing humans? Like, let's question that and let's look at that and then figure out, like, from that place, then figure out, like, great, like, now what is the role that we want technology to play? Yeah. So I also have many thoughts on AI work slop, but I would love, if you have other questions, we can go there.
No, I think we should go to AI work slop, but I think,
I think to your point, there's some great sound bites there. Like, you can cut one of those robots in half and put them back together, or you can turn them off. The reality is, sometimes as a human, I wish I could turn off, you know, that would be cruel. It just keeps running and out. And that goes back to some of our pre-show conversation around opportunities to bring AI in and create some more human experience, solve for not only the upside rewards of using AI well, but also I think what you were explaining, it is kind of the stress and the anxiety moments in the work that we do and the way that we do it.
Well, and I think what's so interesting is because AI, like, there have been so many studies about how even in the last, like, year, people's relationship with AI has changed. It went from, like, I would never talk to a robot to, like, it's my friend, right?
Yes.
And, you know, and I think, like, and it makes sense because I think part of it is this idea of, like, here is something that is judgment-free, always available, will tell me whatever I want to hear, et cetera. We can go into the dangerous aspect of some of that. There is a very dangerous aspect of some of that. But I think it's also one of those things where, like, just because it can play that role also without replacing the role of human beings. Like, I think the reality is both people are chronically under-supported in the workplace.
Yes.
Like, we are chronically under-supported. Managers don't have time to manage. Leaders don't have time to lead. Yeah. Employees are starved for, you know, there's those, like, really sad studies about, like, loneliness in the workplace and so on.
It's terrible.
And it's terrible. And so it's like, if there is a machine that can make, like, give someone a feeling of support, like, that's great. Like, you know, like, let's not rule that out on principle. But let's also figure out, like, how do we not delegate the entirety of that over to the machine? Because that's also not the point, right? Like, I think that's what kind of immediately comes to mind on that front is, like, how do we take the quote unquote, like, humanoid side or the role that AI can play kind of more psychologically that other tech hasn't been able to in the past and use it to fill in the gaps of, like, there's no one, like, I'm not going to call my co-founder at 2 a.m. when I'm, like, thoughts are racing about some idea. I can talk to Claude about it, right? But that also doesn't replace the actual conversation I'm going to have with my co-founder later, right?
Correct.
It can be additive. You know, it's almost like, this is super cheesy, but it's that idea of, like, you know, if you've ever, like, partnered with someone and then you had kids and then you're like, if we have another kid, will we ever be able to love it as much as our first kid?
Being in
like,
that conversation.
You're like, there's like enough love to go around. It's going to like people are starved for support. Like there's enough white space there for both the humans and the AI to step up and be better in that capacity. So
it's fascinating because at the same time, some of the research is showing us now that anxiety and fear of like AI replacing jobs is actually forcing humans in jobs to be like more focused on like the administrative, like, hey, I can show as productive. I did a bunch of work and less going out and connecting with others and less open to innovation and new ideas. So it's almost like on one hand, the AI keeps being touted as, hey, this is going to free us up to do more human stuff. But in the moment, because of the way that we're managing it, we're seeing sort of a negative effect.
Yes. such an excellent point. And this pre-show, we were talking about this idea of like spotting opportunity, right? And this is something we do a lot when we work with leaders, with teams, is we take them through an exercise of how to identify opportunities. We call it like the five friction framework, which is like AI, like identifying and building on AI wins, identifying your work chores, right? Like one of those necessary evil kind of things that you have to do to like keep the trains running up time. Then there's like what would help you achieve your goals faster or better. Then there's like backlog projects, those things you always wanted to do but just were never able to do. And then the last one is AI native thinking, which is how can we kind of really approach work in a totally different way, or use information that we have in a, you know, to create net new value for the world. And the point is, I think the reason I love those five frictions is because, to your point, like if you're sitting here and you're like, the only way that I think can think of to prove value is to prove that I can be more accurate at my work chores than a machine, then like that's like what a grind that is.
It's a losing battle.
And it's a losing battle because essentially as soon as the machine gets good enough, boom, like now you're out of a job, right? And so I think the part of the reason why I love taking people through this and getting them to think about it is because it allows them to have a feeling of more control and agency and to look at things clear-eyed and to say, look, like, for example, I was just talking to a group of engineers who are, you know, very rightfully are very freaked out about like the Block layoffs, right? You know, for readers or listeners, Block laid off 40% of its workforce, citing AI as kind of the rationale. So many thoughts on AI washing for Wall Street. But the point being is like trying to cling on to the old way of software engineering is not going to save you. Mm-hmm. However, understanding enough about the new way of doing it and being of the old world to also understand what are the gaps between the new way and the old way, if anything is going to save you, that's what's going to save you, right? So it's like, so finding those opportunities and helping people kind of like look and see the width and breadth, because I think one chronic issue that I have or that I see when I work with leaders on this, and this is nothing to do, I work with fantastic leaders at like incredibly innovative companies. So like, this is not a shortcoming. This is just, is like freeing humans up for high value work. We often don't even know what that is. Correct. Because how do you envision a world you've never experienced? Like you've not, none of us have ever experienced having 30% more capacity than we have.
Yeah.
And so how do we know? Like, how do we even know what is going to be higher value or so on? And so I think that's another exercise that I recommend everyone go through before they initiate kind of any sort of big AI-ification effort is start to imagine, what do we want on the other side of this, right? The question that I often pose is, if your team had 30% more capacity, what would you do with it?
Yes.
Start there. Then look at the frictions that are getting in the way of that or the leverage that could get you closer to that state. And if you do that exercise, you're in a lot better shape to identify, you know, to kind of also just help give people the certainty of like, this is what we're trying to achieve. And frankly, if that happens to mean like, look, 30% more capacity means we would try to save on headcount, then at least like that's like a clear you know, like that's like a realistic conversation that you can have that I think people appreciate more so than like, maybe if I prove that the machine messes up, then I can prove that my job is worth keeping, which,
it's the job that most people are disengaged in as a starting point and don't enjoy. So like, why are we allowing fear and anxiety to cause people to work harder to do something that they don't enjoy? I mean, that's ludicrous.
Right. Exactly. And like, look, and I will say, I mean, AI makes a lot of there are so many things that generative AI in particular, you're like, LLMs, et cetera. There are so many things that it is not good at. And I think that's another reason why you see so many like pilots fail is because, you know, you're trying to use a you're using a hammer instead of a screwdriver. It's like, sure, like you're going to get a hole, but like, like it's not going to stick. And so, I mean, I think like that's part of why I'm so passionate about the idea of like learn being such a critical part is not that everyone needs to know everything about AI.
Yeah.
But the more you know the tools, the better you can understand how you would use them, how you want them to be used, and how others might use them. Right. So it's all about agency and empowerment.
Yes.
You know, because not knowing about that is not going to help you. It's just going to make it so that if you are lucky enough to get a seat at a decision-making table, your perspective, no matter how valid it is not going to be taken as seriously as the person who can talk the talk about Claude Cowork or something like that. So
yes, it is fascinating. And I've added to our parking lot, not just coming back to slot, but coming back to pilot. So I've got those. We're going to come back.
Yeah.
The five friction framework I love, and you just double clicked on this word learn. I love that you're kind of walking someone through, you know, what are the existing AI wins? What are the work chores? How can we make our goals? How can we enable our goals to be achieved more quickly or better? And then the backlog projects, and then finally the AI native thinking. I love that framing because it encourages you to explore how you're doing work as well as what you've been thinking about without running out there, which I think a lot of companies have done, and just started like deploying AI into existing workplaces, which were rubbish in the first place. So yeah. I like that
negative clause to do the learning.
I mean, one thing that I've seen over the last few years is AI really rewards metacognition. Like the more you can think about your thinking, the better you're going to be able to deploy AI, right? Like automate a bad process. You know, you're just going to get something like the wonky thing faster, right? And so in some ways, what I love about AI is that AI is often the excuse people need to reevaluate and reassess the way work is getting done. Right. I go through teams. I go through this. We do this kind of like AI-ification sprints with functions, for example, where in the end you end with like, you know, we actually build real agents that solve business problems for you. But a big part of that is just that pause to say, all right, how is this going, and why is this process this way? And every single time we do that, people reinvent processes before we have touched AI. They're like, you know, we really don't need to be doing it that way. We used to do it that way because this department used to handle it, but now they don't. Wait a second, why are we generating this report? I don't think anyone reads it anymore or whatever. So I think it's a glorious time for those of us, myself included, who love process optimization.
Yeah, it totally is.
Because this is the excuse you need to kind of like clean house and figure out like, all right, like what, you know, clean house from a process standpoint, and be like, all right, like how do we wish we could operate? And like, maybe this technology can get us closer to that ideal state.
I love that. It actually raises so many tie-ins with other guests I've had on the show. So Luke Williams talks about disruption. He wrote a book on disruption, and he's like, we've got to think about breaking our existing processes down. Now, the problem in most teams is people like, I don't want to put my hand up and say this process is broken because I'm going to upset that person over there. I'm going to create more work. And, you know, I have a target, which is sad. So people who are disengaged are almost incentivized to just stay safe, keep the job safe, and not.
Yeah.
Process improvement. And then the other part that you said about what might be possible in the future, Luke always said, it's not about more cooking. It's about taking the ingredients to make better recipes. And that ties into Brian Evergreen, who we had on the show, who talks a lot about, you know, always build sort of three future outcomes and then rapidly iterate to see how you can get towards those outcomes. Which is becomes a team sport. You can actually bring the team along on the story rather than the team sitting there going, oh, when does our function get taken over? They're actually included. They're encouraged to bring their value, their insights, their perspective, which they all have. Doesn't matter what role someone's in, they're going to know something.
Yeah. And that's like one thing that I think, and this kind of goes back to the point about pilots, is I actually, you know, I have clearly this woman has opinions. I'm like, I don't like employees. I don't like the word pilot. I mean, it's a very valid concept, but I don't love it for a lot of AI implementation because it implies that there is some sort of end state, right? Of like, we pilot and then we launch. And like, the reality is with AI, AI is more like Kaizen. It's continual process improvement, but Kaizen, the Japanese concept of continual process improvement.
Yeah.
Throwback to Toyota in the 80s.
Yeah.
But the idea is, and it's like, so if you say, this is, you know, and I get why in some ways, like, that's an exhausting thing to even think about. It's like, what, we're going to have to think about this forever? Like, we're going to have to continuously optimize? Like, you know, so like, I understand the cycle, like the resistance to kind of embracing that philosophy. But the flip side of that is, again, to that point we were talking about earlier, is like the pressure to find the right thing and the right tool and the right process and have it go right so that you can scale it everywhere versus saying, we're going to assume that we're going to need to change this in 2 months because the tech underneath will have shifted or our org priorities will have shifted and so on. So what can we put in place today that is better than what we have, but we're not looking for some forever solution, right? Because by doing it, we're going to learn what works well, what doesn't, and so on. So I also love it because to your point, to your previous guest point, like this idea of optimization as a team sport, if you can say it's not about like, we're going to create this process and you comply. And it's more of a like, and you see this like again, throwback to the 80s with Toyota and their Kaizen practices. It was like it became like people on the floor in the factory were the ones acting, putting up their hands and being like, you know what, this could be better over here, right? And I think like that's the whole point is like if you make it truly about. This is a team sport and we're all here optimizing and like AI is not, it's not you versus AI. It's whoever has kind of the cleverest idea, right? Yes. On how AI might be able to help. I think it makes it a lot more psychologically safe and you get better outcomes. Like you just get better solutions. So
totally. No, I love that. And I particularly like this concept that pilots can reduce, learning, but they also imply an end state. So they totally change the mindset. Like it's almost limiting, isn't it? If your boss comes in and says, hey, here's another AI pilot, you're like, here we go. We're going to go and see if it solves the problem we thought it might solve, but we're not going to exhaust any effort around curiosity or what if we did it with this and that. And so you just burn through cycles.
Yeah,
it's a problem.
And the fatigue, pilot fatigue is real. And so if you think of it more of like our quest is to, you know, how do we achieve X better? And now let's define better. Now let's figure out what's keeping us from better. And now we're going to run a series of experiments, you know, and we're going to keep what's working and leave what's not. And I'll give you a real example of this. From Clarinet, this is like a real, real deep personal example of about a year ago, we built a proposal generator. If anyone here has ever sold anything, especially as services, you know, proposals are kind of just the bane of your existence.
Yeah.
I love my clients. I love serving them. I hate doing proposals.
And not everyone likes proposals in the same format. So
like, yeah, exactly. Like, but you know, so you know, sub in your own mind the equivalent of proposal for you, right? So it's like, so we were like, we're gonna create this proposal generator that's gonna take a transcript from our call, it's gonna run it through kind of this custom GPT, that's gonna link to Canva, it's gonna create this beautiful proposal that's gonna draft the follow-up email, et cetera. We set this thing up. Of course, the setup took like 5 times longer than you think it would because AI is just like any other tech.
Yeah.
You know, the wireless printer never works the first time around. AI is no different. anyhow, so we set this up and it worked fantastic for about 2 weeks. And then we started to realize maybe it was a month. Maybe we'll give ourselves a month. But we started to realize that because the AI space moves so quickly, our product roadmap moves so quickly, client needs like change and evolve, that we're spending more and more time trying to make sure that the proposal, like that the bot was like up to date on the latest product pitch or whatever, that like we were spending like 2/3 of the time we saved literally editing the output of this bot. And so eventually we decided to like, we were like, we're just going to sunset this proposal generator, because the reality is like the value of us actually creating the proposal is worth more than the value of us trying to get this robot to do it. Right. But, and here's the thing that I love about, like, if we were to treat it like a pilot, we would be like, well, that didn't work. Now let's move on. But if you treat it like an experiment, what we were able to salvage is there is a slice of that workflow where the idea of your transcripts being readily accessible by an LLM. And there was like a sliver of the workflow where we essentially had, we use an AI note taker called Fathom, but this would work with any, with Granola, with any AI note taker. And basically there was a sliver of this workflow, which was as soon as a transcript was generated, a Google Doc gets created in our shared Docs drive. That is that transcript. And that alone has been a massive game changer, because now every conversation we have that is recorded now goes into our organizational context. And it is the backbone of so many other new workflows, because Google Drive integrates with all other platforms, right? So it's kind of like, it's super easy to tap into it in Claude. It's super easy to tap into it in other things and so on. So that's what I mean, is like the quote unquote RFP generator or proposal generator pilot may have failed, but we discovered this piece of it that has been hugely valuable to our business, just not in that particular context. And so I think that that to me is like that learning extraction process is so critical, because there are so many examples of that, like even amongst our clients, of like, what did work about this? Ah, are there any, like, what are the lookalikes, and like, how do we leverage that? There's always an AI win in there somewhere. But if you aren't thinking about looking for it, then
you just throw the whole thing out.
We're back to square one every single time. And again, that's exhausting. So
that's a cool example. I really appreciate you sharing that. And what I think's interesting about the proposal generator and that slice that you took away is that so often, going back to our earlier point, people don't put their hands up to say, hey, this is broken, or we can do this work better. And therefore, our work gets very isolated. We've driven so hard towards efficiency. That there's one person on the team that writes proposals, and when they're out sick, child's not well, you know, on vacation, the whole team just gets hammered because we can't get proposals out. And salespeople hate having to give people who write proposals any appropriate readiness time. It's just like, hey, I need it tomorrow. So it's interesting with your Google example, when you've got the documentation, you allow what were bottlenecks in an organization to create opportunities for other people to collaborate and work on other people's work.
And that's exactly. So I'll give you another example. This is something that we worked with a client to do this, and then we actually adopted it internally, because we were like, that's a great idea. Like, that's a cool solution that we came up with together. Like, let's do it. For example, because we have all of these transcripts, you know, I do a lot of events and so on as a co-founder. My marketing person can prep for events for me, because she's like, I pulled a bunch of talking points from like previous things that you've done. This is what's relevant and so on. And I mean, that's not to say, like, clearly I prepare as well. But the point is, like, she's able to do that.
Yeah.
Whereas like previously, like that would have been really hard for someone to do. And so it just like opens it up to like, what are the cool things? Like another example, a company we worked for, we were helping AIify one of their functions, and they were like, one of their bottlenecks was they have like a really high candidate experience NPS that they want to hit, and they're hiring at a very rapid clip. And one of the bottlenecks was hiring managers giving feedback, because basically
I know that one well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like gave kind of really bad feedback or they would drag their feet on giving feedback because they wanted it to be good and, you know, that kind of thing. And so they were like, well, let's take examples of really good feedback and bad feedback. And like basically together, like in this call, we created a hiring manager feedback coach agent that essentially immediately after a call, that it would pull the transcript from the call, right? Because all of their interviews were recorded. That's pretty standard. And the hiring manager, it would ask the hiring manager a couple of key questions and it would generate a first draft of feedback based on the response of the manager and also took into account things like what are you legally not allowed to give feedback on in an interview, right? So like, because that was another like headache.
Also a big problem. Yeah.
Right? Also a big problem. Like you can't give feedback on like, I don't know, protected information or whatever. And so like that kind of was this example of this idea of, you know, flipping the script of the, like, how do we, I don't know, automate this or whatever to like, okay, what if we were able to give one-on-one support to every single hiring manager after every single interview? And that's an example of like, you take the work chore and then it starts to become this AI native thinking, right? Because you're kind of like, well, we have access to the transcripts. We have access of like what good and bad looks like. It's pretty straightforward. You know, like we pretty much want them to give feedback on the same types of things every time. Like we know what is off limits, like all of those ingredients coming together, but it took a little, you know, like you have to kind of unpattern, right? Like you have to not think about it the way that you historically thought about it. And now they're able to accomplish two things, which is like achieve more of the velocity they want to achieve and give higher quality feedback to candidates. So like, you know,
which
a good
has got
example.
So many learning. It's got good candidate experience moments, but it's also got great learning for like how we change our requisitions, where we source from, how we run our early interviews. So the whole system is healthier.
See, like there we go. And now your wheels are spinning of like, what else could we be doing? And like, you know, so and I think that's that biggest thing of like unlocking of like thinking about, you know, I think so often when people are feeling the pressure of like AI native and this and that, it's especially for people who maybe are not as technical, this idea, it's like, how do you wish it could be? And then like, what are the ingredients you need in order to make that happen? And a lot of them are actually like much closer than you think, you know, as long as you're willing to kind of, you know, go with like good, but not perfect, right?
Yes.
You know, like this is not perfect. Like this, I'm sure there are plenty of issues with this widget, but
but it's going to be better that you're doing the learning. And this probably ties neatly back to our whole point on sloth that we've got to revisit. Mm-hmm. It's probably that AI native thinking gives you better opportunities to be like, hey, instead of going and piloting 15 tools this year, let's start working out where in our workflow or our process that we want to build and how we can iterate and learn. Because then you do get those aha moments and everyone's activated because they're learning that it's okay to fail. It's okay to throw something out there that doesn't work. So something tells me that you're going to have more eyes on the road with that approach.
Well, and so I'll talk about AI slop. And I think there's two dimensions of slop. One is linking it slop to pilots is I think way too many people, and this is not the fault of the people, this is just because this is how tech is marketed, honestly, is like, it should be business first, tech second. So you need to come at it from the, like, if something is not valuable to your business, it does not matter if AI can do it well. like a great example is like, you know, a lot of like, there's like AI recruiters now, like as in like avatars you can talk to. It's honestly, it's fantastic from like a, like, let's say you're like, great, I don't want to have someone have to fill out like a 5-page application. I could just have them talk to an avatar. Like, great. If you're hiring for a high volume role where like you're asking the same questions, that's going to be a good use of time and money to test that out.
Yeah.
If you're only if your business is shrinking or you're only dealing with executive recruitment, this is going to be a huge waste of time.
And terrible experience.
A terrible experience because no senior exec candidate wants to talk first to an avatar, right? And so, I mean, so I think it's like first focus on like what is valuable to your business today or tomorrow, et cetera. Like, and then what are the tools that I need? And like, what is the change that I need to make that happen? So that's how you avoid kind of the slop version of pilots, is like tinkering with tools that are like, this doesn't actually solve a real problem for us. So yeah, why would we waste time on looking into it, right? And so then the other thing is like AI slop, and like I'm hearing this all over the place. Like in their studies again, like it's, I think like a Workday released one where it's like 30% of time savings from AI are spent like correcting AI mistakes. And unfortunately, it tends to be the manager that's correcting. It's not the generator of the slop. It's like the person above them or a peer who are who are correcting. And so I think basically this is all about mindset shift of that idea of like, if AI, if learning to use AI well is about delegating to a machine, you also still need to figure out how to delegate to the human delegating to the machine, right?
Yes.
So like the skill of delegation does not go away. And the number one thing that I see people miss, and like the simplest thing that you can do, honestly, is like sit down with whoever you're working with and be like, here's what I want. Write the prompt that you would write. Great. Here's what I would add. Here's the context that's missing.
Here's what you want,
right? Like we often talk about like role goal questions is like our prompt formula is like, what is the role AI is playing? What is the goal? What is success for the task? And then ask me questions to optimize my output. And the thing is, if you have AI ask you questions to optimize the output, My prediction is anyone who's producing AI slop is producing AI slop because oftentimes, because they don't actually know the answers to the questions
that the AI asked,
right? About the nuance of the thing, right? It's like they're producing something long and polished looking because maybe they're not actually an expert in the thing and they don't actually know what like really good for XYZ looks like, or maybe you've given them a relatively vague, you know, task or et cetera. So I think that idea of like QA, quality assurance, needs to be pushed down to the level of the front line. And so you need to teach your front line to QA their own work, which means giving them more expertise, right? And this is one of those things that's so interesting. And time, exactly. And time is like, what we're seeing in some, we work with some companies that are like really great at recruiting like very kind of fresh out of school, kind of young folks. And what they're seeing is that AI training with those groups, or what we're seeing is we don't need to teach them the tools. They've been using ChatGPT for 3 years to get through college.
Yes.
What we need to teach them is judgment and discernment of like, this is what a good version of this task looks like. This is what a bad version of the output looks like, right? That's what you need to teach, because they haven't had the experience that maybe, you know, an elder millennial like myself has gone through of like, I've written like 50,000 job descriptions by hand. And that's why I know what a good job description looks like versus a bad one. So it's kind of how do you help people develop expertise when they're not organically getting the reps that we got?
Yes.
So, you know, I think that's going to be something that more and more and more is going to be really important for leaders to like factor in to ensure that the AI slot problem gets better, not worse.
I think that one's huge on pushing QA to the front line, giving them the time and resources to get the outline of the task right before they take the output and start moving and kind of distorting everything in the system. We had a guest, Greg Wilton, on the show who was like, the reality is that the AI is going to work best in a team that is really well codified around how they get work done and how they maintain their knowledge management. Because when that's the case, in the future, you're going to be able to plug into your knowledge management database. And actually, if Diane or Dane aren't available and that frontline worker is starting a task, they could say, what would Dane approach this? Or how has Dane approached that? Or Diane approached that in the past? So I think it does kind of wave a big flag to say all leaders, all teams need to be thinking about really codifying and building good process in their teams rather than letting the AI just kind of punch it out periodically.
100%.
That's super cool. Well, we've covered some great ground today, Diane. I love that you were just so candid in saying
these agents are not on the org chart. Like, it's a great opinion to hold for if we're thinking about AI helping humans first. I think it's a healthy constraint to create.
I thought the fact that
we already, as humans, working with other humans, have issues with delegation means that there's a lot of human skill building that we need to be doing. And that came out in this last point on the QA. So that's really there. The fact that humans in work are chronically under-supported. We see a lot of the data out there on connection and burnout, but it is an opportunity to think, going back to your question of what would you do with 30% more capacity? How can we build that scaffolding so that we're creating the social connection and support for trying new things, taking risks, being involved in that improvement process? Love that piece. And then as we came back down, my probably soundbite for the whole episode was when you said AI is the excuse that people need to reevaluate how work gets done. Like, that should be the problem in the title of this episode, because it's particularly going
to your five friction framework.
Yeah.
It's a great moment. It is a great opportunity to be in a workplace.
If you can get excited about that, then you can get excited about AI, because fundamentally, again, human first, business first, AI second, right?
Yeah, totally.
That's at the heart of it.
That's it. So, and we did get to pilots and slop. So we covered a lot of ground. How do our listeners find you or find Clarinet
if they want to continue more of these discussions and learning?
I mean, you know, and we would love to have those discussions with you, listeners. So we are Clarinet, like the instrument. Our website is clarinet.io. And you can also find me on LinkedIn, Diane Sadowski-Joseph. I love to chat with people, so feel free to connect with me or with Clarinet there as well. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Well, thanks again. I look forward to continuing the journey and checking back in
on what's new in another 6 months or so.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
You're welcome. Thanks, Dan.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.